Hi, today is October 22nd, 2017. This is Mobius Podcast 227, in which we are titling The Case of the Missing Mac Mini Date. So, Tato Gaswar, good friend John Westfall, and Mac Mini.
Yeah, our good friend, both of our former good friend, the Mac Mini.
Yeah, I think we're 1,088 days since the last refresh.
The Mac Mini at this point has been lost at sea and lost in an abyss of sadness. But this week, as you note, there might be some life left in the old gal.
Well, or guy.
Yep, or something.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently some Mac Mini fan sent an email to Tim Cook lamenting the lack of a refresh of the Mac Mini, and I guess basically asking if it's dead. And Tim Cook says, no, we have plans for it, or whatever.
It will be a large part. It's going to be a large part of our lineup. Now, whether that means it'll be released or it will be broken down into component parts that will go into other things, we're not quite sure what he means. The exact quote was, I'm glad you love the Mac Mini. We love it too. Our customers have found so many creative and interesting uses for the Mac Mini. Yeah. While it is not time to share any details, we do plan for the Mac Mini to be an important part of our product line going forward.
Okay, so here's my conspiracy views theory. And the conspiracy views theory is that if it's going to be a large part of the product line, that means they're going to kill off the rest of the desktop models and only the Mac Mini will be left.
I actually was going the other conspiracy theory way. It's going to be a large, so they're going to stop making Mac Minis. They're going to be just, you know, iMacs, because it'll be large. Yeah. They'll bill it as, you know, the Mac Mini has grown up.
With a screen.
Yeah, and it'll just be an iMac at that point.
That's sad. You know, I still have one iMac. My 2008 iMac is going to be 10 years old soon. Still works, and it's a great device, but you know, having had an all-in-one, and it's the only all-in-one I've ever had, I don't like an all-in-one. I would rather have a small, less expensive device that can attach the screen of my choice to, you know, because basically the iMac, if the iMac did not have a screen, if it was a, you know, pumped up Mac Mini from back then, I could have added a much nicer screen than was available 10 years ago to it by now.
Well, it's interesting. I have two 27-inch cinema displays that I've used now, and I think they're about, I think next year in February they'll turn 8. So I've had them for quite a while, and I thought, you know, what would happen when they will inevitably die? And, you know, Apple makes some nice stuff, but it's not like they're the only one in the market that makes something along those lines. And 7 years ago, 8 years ago, for a giant display that, you know, kind of had the built-in everything and looked really nice, Apple was a good player. Now, there are a lot of options. So, same thing with Mac Mini. A lot of ways to go that you might not have had 10 years ago when Mac Mini actually came out.
Yeah, but unless you go with what is called Franken-Mac or whatever, they're going to be running not Mac OS.
That's true. And that is really the only thing. So I put in our show notes, would we even buy one?
Yeah.
For me, the only thing I don't have anymore that I had with my Mac Mini was I could run Profile Manager and set up the device management for Macs and iPhones and iPads. And that was kind of fun to play with. It actually helped a little bit streamlining different configurations to push them out at one point to all of my – back when I used to have an iPhone and three iPads. But now that I'm down to one iPhone and one iPad, I really don't need that as much anymore. So I don't really think I'd buy it unless it was super, super cheap, like $500-ish, in which case I could justify it as a fun play toy. But
right. Right. And didn't you also, I don't think it's available anymore, but didn't you also run Mac OS Server on it?
Yeah, you can still get Mac OS Server.
Oh, you can? Okay.
It's just a download in the App Store for anyone who wants it. So you can actually run Mac OS Server on any Mac.
Okay, but it's just handy on a Mac Mini.
Yeah, and so, but I have two old MacBooks over here that I could always resurrect. I've got a 2009 13-inch MacBook Pro and a 2011 MacBook Air and my 2015 MacBook Pro. So if I really want to, I could run macOS and Profile Manager on some hardware over here. Right.
Well, you know, my one and only Mac Mini was the original Mac Mini running PowerPC G4. Didn't even run an Intel chip, so it wouldn't be much good today. But I really did enjoy it, and I think I paid... did I pay the base price, $499, or did I pump it up a little? I can't remember. But my recollection was it did start at $499 back then. I think it doesn't anymore. I'm kind of puzzling over that. Let me go check that. What's the current Mac Mini price? 2017. Let's see.
Survey
starts at $499.
Huh?
Yeah, still starts at $499. Now you don't get much.
Yeah,
but. But it's not bad, really. It's a 1.4 gigahertz processor, 500 gigs of storage, which is pretty good, 4 gigs of RAM, which is acceptable. Yeah, Intel graphics chip, $499.
No, we shall see.
Yeah, yeah. For me, the thing is these podcasts, because I have yet to find a piece of software that runs on my Windows PC that records podcasts from Skype as well as Audio Hijack 2. Audio Hijack 3, which you're using right now, I'm not so sure about. But it is working, so I'm not going to badmouth it. It took me a while to figure out a few things, but at least we're able to record now, so I'm a little bit happier. But it only runs on Mac OS, and that means in the past, 9 years? Come next month, I'll be recording this podcast 9 years. It's gone from recording on a iMac to a MacBook Air, the original 2010, to a MacBook Pro 2009, which is actually more powerful than a 2010 MacBook Air. When I inherited that from my daughter when she went to college, I got her high school MacBook. And most recently, I am now running a brand spanking new 2013 MacBook Air, which I also inherited from my daughter. She got a 2017, which also hasn't been updated in a while, by the way. I say 2017, but we bought it this year, but it hasn't had a refresh in, well over a year, I think. So the only way I can record these podcasts is to buy a Mac, or I guess I could subscribe to that Zoom thing we tested a while back.
Mm-hmm.
That worked pretty well, and I guess is it cheaper than buying a MacBook? I mean, a Mac Mini? I'm not sure. Might be.
Depends on how long the Mac Mini will last.
Yeah, but and it's funny because the Mac Mini is the only Mac I've had that hasn't lasted. It died shortly after its extended warranty, its Apple Care warranty, went out. Its system board blew out, and it was too cheap to go fix it. Plus, I didn't know if I could. I know you've done that. You've opened up your Mac Mini.
Yeah, I did it one time, but then mine eventually did die about two months ago now. So
yeah, but every other Mac I've had, I guess except for the Mac Mini, has had a really nice life. I also have one of those Parley Carbonate G4 MacBooks from way back when, 2000. I don't know when it was, 2008, I guess, 2007, something like that. But they all still work. Well, like I said, I've been using the MacBook Air and MacBook Pro, start 2010 devices. The 2008 iMac still works. So Apple products last a long time. So hopefully if the new Mac Minis are more robust than my original one, and it sounds like you got a number of years out of yours.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'd consider buying it versus, spending another $1,500 on a tricked out MacBook Air or something.
That's true. I don't know if I'll ever have need of a solo stay at home. You are the one that will travel without a full notebook. Yep. I like to travel with my MacBook and with my Surface tablet. So
yeah, you travel with both, which I find them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, at least now I'm just traveling with a MacBook, a Surface, an iPad, an iPhone.
Yeah, there you go. So it's light.
Yeah, it's a lot lighter for me. It used to be, add three more iPads onto that.
Yeah, that was cray-cray, but okay.
Yeah, I agree.
So, you're kind of moderately interested if the price is right. I'm still, I would say, moderately high interested, so a bit more than you. It's not like if a new one came out, I would rush out to go buy one, but I would certainly be, my interest would certainly be piqued, and I would certainly go take a look at it and give it some thought, and maybe buy one. I really think I would. I really think I would. Just in case. And it'd be nice to have something with I don't know, something newer than 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Okay. Next up is something I've been kind of puzzling over. I'm trying to understand why this is interesting. So if you buy a new Pixel 2 or Pixel 2 XL phone from Google, one of the things you get for, let's see, I guess 2-3 years maybe up to 2020, is unlimited photo storage in Google Photos. Now you'd say, well, I already have unlimited storage. No, most of us don't. So here's the difference, and I'm still trying to understand why this matters to me. Okay. If you have Google, if you have a Google account and use Google Photos, you can store an unlimited number of photos, at least so far. And the only gotcha is that if it's more than 16 gigapixels in resolution, they will start compressing it more in the down below 16. So if you have a 20 megapixel camera, you'll never get 20 megapixels. You get, you know, some sub 16 megapixel compressed version. Now, the truth is they compress everything. So even the sub 16 megapixel photos you upload from your phone or whatever now, if you don't have unlimited storage, or what they call unlimited, you will still get some, it basically is not identical to the photo on your phone or your camera or whatever, even if it's submix. Okay, so okay, and basically I'm okay with that. You know, when I look at the photos, I guess maybe my eyes are old or something, but I can't tell the difference between, you know, the original photo and whatever magic Google's applying to it. But if you buy a Pixel 2 or Pixel 2 XL, they, you know, I read in BGR, Boy Genius Report, it used to be called Boy Genius Report, that you will get unlimited photo storage. Let me rephrase that. Yeah, unlimited photo storage until like 2020, so 2 or 3 years. And by unlimited, now if you have a photo that is 60 megapixels or more, they will not compress it. In fact, I guess they won't compress any of your photos. So the question for me is, and I need to go dig into the, go read the article again and go look up more things since I have a Pixel 2 somewhere in the queue, is does that apply to all photos I upload? Or just the photos from the Pixel 2 that get this non-compression mode? If it's all photos, including my iPhone and whatever, that'd be kind of nice. I mean, I don't have anything that shoots more than 16 megapixels resolution, but it'd be nice to have uncompressed photos stored there. If it's only the phone, the phone only has a 12 megapixel camera, so, you know, I'm not sure if this is a big deal or not yet, in other words, but I'm looking forward to it. Did you start using Google Photos, John? I can't remember.
I do. I actually have all of my photos on Google Photos. I've been very happy with it because I didn't really have a good photo organization strategy until then. However, The QNAP NAS that I bought actually has plenty of space, and Plex, the media server I've been using, will let you do photos and has pretty much all the same features as Google. So I think I'll still keep backing up to Google because I like having the ability to create albums and share them out easily. But Plex is sort of a nice backup for the raw, high-res images that I want to keep. So I always keep the original files for all of my photos and videos just because that's how I was raised. I'm not used to letting the cloud have the only copy of something.
I should mention, you know, now that you bring it up, I didn't mention it in my long, rambling description of Google Photos, but I have had issues with raw photos, raw format photos, of uploading it to Google Photos. And I'm not sure it's simply because it doesn't support it, or it just didn't support that version of raw. I think they were from like an old Canon G4, PowerShot G4 camera. But they wouldn't upload. So, you know, I have those backed up elsewhere, but still, it's kind of an interesting issue.
And when are you looking to get your Pixel 2? Do you have any idea?
Hopefully this month.
Okay.
Hopefully this month. And I am a little bit afraid of the OLED burn-in I've seen reported on the web. So that'll be kind of interesting. But on a happier note, and we'll probably talk about it since I get it in, hopefully next couple of weeks. On a happier note, for those of you pet owners, specifically with a dog or cat, Google Photos will now let you ID your pet. So it now has snout ID, snout recognition. Well, I guess cats don't have snouts. But it has snout recognition for dogs, or the ones that have snouts anyway, if you don't have a pug or something. And you know, that's pretty important. And although it wasn't designed to work with rabbits, and we have pet rabbits here in our home, it does kind of recognize them. It probably thinks they're a cat, because Google mistakes the rabbits for all kinds of animals. Cats and bears and pandas and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, my.
Oh, my, indeed. But there you go. You can now put a name on your dog or cat, and it will go through your Google Photos and collect them all. Well, maybe not all, but many of them into a, you know, a person, so to speak. Now, you have cats, don't you? Oh, wait, no. Wait,
I had a cat, now I'm down to a betta fish and a parakeet.
I remember. Sorry for your loss.
I don't think, it's interesting. I don't know if Google Photos actually recognizes my parakeets. So if I do a search for just birds, I'm wondering
it'll find birds.
Yeah.
It's also identified the rabbits as birds, by the way. If I search for birds, it'll bring the photos of the rabbits up.
That's somewhat bizarre.
Yeah.
But
a rabbit is apparently a universal animal.
You're trying, Google. You really are.
Yeah. But you can do things like search for a red bird. You know, I don't know what color your parakeets are, but, you know, if you've ever taken a photo of a red bird, you know, in a park or whatever, it will find those kind of things. It's pretty amazing. I have to say its ability to use natural language to identify photographs is quite impressive. It's kind of things we used to dream about years ago, and now you do it for free. It's kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next up, so speaking of Pixel and Pixel 2, so this website, gearsofbiz.com, reports that the Pixel 2 can do something I've never understood why Android doesn't do, and that's something iPhone has done for a long time, and that gives you a battery indicator of connected Bluetooth devices. Now, not all Bluetooth devices report battery percentages, you know, battery status to your iPhone, but many do. Certainly my Bluetooth earbuds and speaker and, you know, Apple Pencil, things like that, they'll tell you how much battery you have left. But Android devices never tell you. It just drove me bonkies. Like, oh, how much do I have left? And Android going, I don't know. But apparently if you have a Pixel 2 running Oreo, and it only runs Oreo, it has some kind of battery indicator now, so we'll wait and see if it actually works for me when I get it in. Looking forward to that. I now wish that, I don't think Mac OS does that either with connected devices, although not anything connected. And I know for sure Windows doesn't. Of course, Windows barely connects to anything.
I can get a little bit of device on my Bluetooth, like my trackpad. I actually don't have my trackpad connected right now, but it usually does show me some level of battery indication. So.
Okay, I'm looking to see if I don't think I have anything connected to Bluetooth right now. No. And in fact, the only thing that I have that will connect to Bluetooth on my Mac is my Amazon Echo, so which is plugged in, so it wouldn't do much good. Okay, you discovered something interesting on your watch, or for your watch.
Well, yeah. So years ago, when I used a Fitbit One full-time, and before that a Fitbit Ultra, and before that the original Fitbit, I made use of the sleep tracking features of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I switched over to an Apple Watch, I found a sleep tracking app on iOS called Sleep Cycle that did a pretty good job, but it didn't track motion. It would just lay next to your bed and use sound recordings to know what if you were moving around, things like that. It was okay, but I still missed kind of the motion recording to really know what my sleep cycle looked like. So yesterday I was looking at my old Apple Watch, my Series 0 that has been sitting in a drawer since I got my Series 3 a few weeks ago.
Ah.
And I, yeah, now you're starting to see the answer to your question that you're asking. And I thought, well, what can I do with this thing? I thought, I wonder if there are any sleep tracking apps that I could, you know, charge this thing during the day and then wear this one at night while I sleep, and it would track my sleep, and then in the morning swap for my Series 3.
Right.
And I did find an app. It's called Pillow, P-I-L-L-W. It's free, but it does have some premium features you can unlock. I think the premium unlock is a one-time $5 charge.
Okay.
But the cool thing about it is that it will track through the motion on the Apple Watch, and it combines with the idea of using audio recording and things like that. And it gives you the adaptive wake up, so if you want to set your alarm for kind of the last possible moment to wake you up, it'll look at your sleep cycle at that point and wake you up in time for that. And it produces some very nice little graphs that I'm showing Todd right now over Skype, where you can kind of see when you were in deep sleep and when you were in light sleep. And so I'm pretty happy with that. Now, if you do not have the luxury of having an old Apple Watch.
Yeah, as I don't.
Yeah, purely for your night watch. That was the other one last night, sleeping with a watch on. I haven't done that in years and never really did it regularly, even though when I have my Pebble, I could have, because the Pebble didn't need to be charged very often.
Yeah, long
time. But the Apple Watch takes about, in my experience, it takes about 2 to 2.5 hours to go from 0% to 100% charge.
Yeah.
So if you've only got, if you're using one watch and you wear it during the day, you'll probably get it down to around 30, 20%. If you pop it on the charger for about an hour before bed, you probably will have plenty of energy for that night the next day to get it back up to where you need it to be. So it's not the best solution, but if you only got one watch, you still could use Pillow. You just have to, you know, perhaps an hour and a half before bed, throw your watch on the charger and have it ready for the night.
Yeah, that's, you see, and that's a great thing about the Fitbit, right? At least for me. So the Fitbit is the Fitbit One, which is a non-wrist device, but you can put it in your wrist with a little elasticy thing that ships with it. The charge lasts for days, if not, you know, in the old days, I might charge it for 5 days or so. Now it's probably down to 3 or 4 before I have to recharge it. But I really didn't have to worry about it. I just, you know, put it on my wrist, and it's not heavy. It's not nearly as heavy as the watch.
The other benefit of the Apple Watch, and I'm not sure if modern Fitbits, the wrist-based ones, will do this or not, but it actually records heart rate data all the time, too, and that can sync up with Pillow. And show when, you know, what my heart rate was and while I was sleeping and things like that. So that's kind of cool to look at.
You know, speaking of heart rate, so is that something new with the Series 3 or WatchOS 4 or whatever?
No,
I thought it always had it.
It's always had it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they get a little bit better heart rate each time. But no, the original Apple Watch shipped with heart rate sensor without a problem. So I've never had a problem with using it.
Since you've had your Apple Watch much, you know, longer than I've had mine.
April 2015.
Have you looked up this heart rate variability thing and that's reported? I don't know what it means. I've looked it up and I've seen definitions of it, but I haven't read anything tells me how to interpret it.
I have not. I actually just noticed it for the first time recently, and I haven't done too much
to
investigate it further. It might be a new thing to look at that. Now, I did have the first heart rate notification pop on mine a few weeks ago, and it was at a day when I had to give an important presentation, so I might have been a little stressed out, but I was also wearing a dress shirt and a t-shirt that were keeping me kind of running hot that day. So I think I was overheating. And so my heart rate was up, but it was kind of cool to see that trigger. I hope not to see it trigger ever again, but at least I could see what was going on that was getting my heart rate up. And then later that day after, you know, I had a chance to relax and calm down, I was back down to my normal heart rate. So,
so that's called the elevated heart rate notification, right?
Yes. And I've had one of them. Hope to never have one again.
Yeah, really.
But we do know of cases where people have been saved by their heart rate monitor in an Apple Watch or otherwise, although the Apple Watch ones tend to get more PR, where people have tachycardia, whatever, hyper tachycardia, and go to the hospital and realize, hey, good thing you came in because you're running a little fast.
Yeah. Well, if anybody, if our fives of listeners, if any amongst you know what the heart rate variability, well, not know what it is, how to interpret it, what does it mean? You know, I'm looking at this heart rate variability thing, and it says, oh, you know, for the past week, my average is 20 milliseconds. Is that good? Is that bad? Is that normal? Or, you know, normal for me? You know, is that something you combine with your BMI and other kinds of things to tell you, you know, to interpret it? It doesn't say. All it says is heart rate variability, HRV, is a measure of the variation in time interval between one heartbeat and next. Okay, that makes sense. Slight variation between beats is normal. Okay, that's fine too. But what's normal?
Well, you are at 20 and I am at 30 milliseconds.
Okay, see? So one of us is going to die soon, but we don't know. No, I don't know. But we don't know how to interpret that, right? Is yours better? Is yours worse? Is, you know, we just don't know. I think higher variability is better, by the way, but I don't know what higher means. It's like, is 30 still considered low variability? Should we be at like 100 millisecond variability? I don't know. Anyway, if somebody knows, please.
There are no decent answers to.
Explain this to we non-medical lay type people. That said, I've been following my heart rate religiously. I don't know why. It doesn't really tell me much. I have not had an alert yet, so I'm thankful for that. But, I don't have a reporting on my wrist. Oh, I should also note something else. I think my Android watch used to do that too. I think Android Wear has a built-in heart rate monitor, but I never used it. Well, let me rephrase that. I never used it after the first couple of days because it was killing my battery. On my Moto 360. Yeah. So it was killing my battery, so I said, okay, we're not going to do this. And also, what else was I doing at the Android Wear? I think I was having it unlock my phone when it was within proximity. And basically, if I was wearing my watch and I had my, you know, my Nexus 6 with me, it would, like, unlock it without me having to hit a pin because there's no fingerprint reader in Nexus 6. But I think that also killed the battery life. So I'm not doing it. Now, I think I have it set with one of my Macs so that when I'm within proximity of my MacBook, it will unlock it from sleep without a password.
Mm-hmm.
So I have turned that on, and I don't use my Mac frequently. In fact, I only use it basically once or twice a week to record these podcasts, but it is handy those few times. And last week I was upgrading everything to High Sierra, so I now have two machines running High Sierra, my MacBook Air and my MacBook Air. Well, and also my MacBook Air, 2010 and 2020. I don't think I've tried it with the Pro yet, which still works but has a broken Wi-Fi, so I had to buy a USB Wi-Fi for it a while back, as our fives of listeners may recall.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now speaking of heart, I read something in the Wall Street Journal that gives you a pause for thought. So, Internet of Things. When we think of Internet of Things, we usually think about, you know, thermostats and Amazon Echoes and things like that. But another Internet of Things, pacemakers. And apparently an Abbott pacemaker, of which there are hundreds of thousands installed with some kind of data reporting, presumably through Wi-Fi. I don't know what it's using, but you know, that reports back to your physician so that he or she can read your pacemaker activity remotely. Abbott has been fixing it. Now, let me rephrase it. Patching it. It's not broken. Patching it for security because it is an IoT device. And apparently it's pretty wide open until now. But the problem is that the medical community, I guess the cardiologists, it has to be done in, you know, it's not like an over-the-air thing. You do it all. You need to be in a medical facility with a trained professional to update this thing for obvious reasons. But apparently some of the cardiologists and so forth are concerned about applying this patch because they have apparently been about a dozen reports of malfunctions during the upgrade process. Now, whether or not it's related to the upgrade process, I don't know. But, you know, if it happens during the upgrade process, at least there's a high probability that it might be related. And with something like a pacemaker, you're, you know, understandably concerned about about, you know, applying a patch during for something like that. So, you know, since you got to really think about this one. It's like, wow, you know, somebody's life is in your hands. Do you really want to update that? It's, you know, having your machine bricked is one thing when it's your, you know, it's a desktop PC. You have to update. You know, it's like, yes, you're angry. Yes, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? You can replace it. You can, you know, reformat it. Pacemaker malfunction during update, that's a whole heck of another thing. And I,
yeah, having your heart bricked is a bad thing.
Bad, bad, bad thing. So, don't want to scare anybody, but you know, talk to your cardiologist, see what he or she thinks before you update your pacemaker, and do your own risk assessment, I guess, is the advice.
It's interesting though, because for those devices, how configurable are they by the patient? You know, it's, if I decide, can I turn off the Wi-Fi or turn off the Bluetooth or whatever radio it's got going on, and how would I then turn it back on if I wanted to? It's a unique case.
Yeah. So my guess is, and I am not a medical professional of any kind, but I'm going to look it up now. IoT pacemaker adjustments. My guess is that
It'd be kind of cool if you just jump up and down like six times and that activates the radio and then, you know.
Well, my guess is that it probably has something to do about adjusting how the pacemaker actually works to kind of jumpstart your heart every now and then. Basically, that's what it's doing, right? It's kind of adjusting the rhythm of your heartbeat so that you have a nice, even pace. So I would guess that what the pacemaker does is, you know, it can be adjusted to look at your or learn based on how your heart has been behaving, on what it should do and when, to adjust itself. Here's something interesting. So according, I'm looking at a 2016 Wired article, and it's not Wi-Fi. And you know, if I think about it, it'd be kind of crazy to put Wi-Fi in your body because the battery alone would be like, you know,
yeah.
But apparently, it uses NFC to communicate. So, you know, tacking you would not be something to be done long distance, I would guess. You know, you'd have to, you know, NFC has a fairly limited, what, about a meter? Maybe less? So blah, blah, blah. Pacemakers are vulnerable. University of Michigan showed that it's possible to extract sensitive personal information from a pacemaker or even threaten the patient's life by turning off or changing the pacing behavior, which is what I was kind of guessing. That's what it's called, pacing behavior. Fortunately, such an attack requires close proximity to the patient and could not be carried out remotely. So it's not like something your worst enemy is going to do to you from, you know, half a continent away.
No, but if you anger your spouse sufficiently, that is where you might get in trouble.
Wow, that's a, you know, that would make a heck of a police procedural episode, you know? Right?
That would. And if it happens, we called it. I'm sure it will happen. So.
Yeah. Okay, now as far as the distance, okay, this is weird. I'm going to read the whole thing. So distance, you know, I was saying about a meter. Okay, I'm going to read the whole paragraph, which I normally don't do because I hate it when people do that. But this is from a 2016 more Wired article, or article in Wired. And it says, a more threatening attack scenario is developed by the hacker Barnaby Jack, who is planning to give a lecture at the Black Hat Conference in 2013 about the possibility of remotely controlling pacemakers via wireless communications at 15 meters distance. So that's about 50 feet, just shy of 50 feet. Okay, here's the kicker. Sadly, he died just before the conference, and his research has not been pursued.
Okay, that is... somewhat scary.
Tell me that's not a movie.
Yeah, that is. Somebody does not want you to know about what he found.
I guess I know what I'm not going to be doing any research in ever in my entire life. Just to let folks know, I have no interest in this at all. Except as, you know.
Todd is not doing any research on this or anything else you may want to off him over.
That's right. Nothing. Nothing. Yikes. Anyway, it's very scary stuff and, you know, very serious stuff. Talk to your, you know, so now maybe you got to talk, and I say this in slightly, but I don't mean it that way. You may need to talk to both a cybersecurity expert and your cardiologist before making a decision. You know, what is the risk level, right? Personally, I think the hacking risk level is pretty low unless you're somebody famous or infamous or whatever. But I would do it. I would do it if I were in the hands of a competent cardiologist in a setting that could, you know, kind of restart me if something went wrong during the update process. Just to feel safe, you know, in general. Okay, and that's about all I have, John, unless you have something to add.
No, I believe that we've covered pretty much everything that I can think of.
Yeah, it wasn't really a big week, was it?
I will find it interesting because you have ordered your Pixel.
Yes, I have.
And I am planning on ordering an iPhone 10 this Friday.
Oh, is this the week already?
Yeah, this is the week coming up. So we will see who gets their device first. I think you'll probably get it first. I hope, actually.
I'm hoping I get my first.
We'll have definitely some things to talk about in the near future when it comes to new devices.
Yeah. And I will say I did order the OtterBox for the Pixel 2. Even though I don't know, an OtterBox very honestly said they're not sure either if it will work with the squeeze to activate Google Assistant feature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really too keen on using Google Assistant that much, so I really don't care too much if it doesn't work with the case on. I'm more concerned about protecting the phones, but it's the Defender series. So those of you familiar with OtterBox Defender series, it's not quite a tank, but it's an armored vehicle of some kind. and it comes with a built-in screen protector, which is kind of neat, because I don't know about you, John, but I am, you know, mostly thumbs when I try to press it down and get all the bubbles out and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this one, the screen protector is just part of the case, and when you put it in the case, boom, your screen has a screen protector on it. So
yeah, I've used OtterBoxes that do that. They come out pretty nice. So.
Yeah, no bubbles, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I just got to make sure it's clean when you put it on, but, you know, relatively easy to take care of. Anyway, it's here, and so I have a case, but no phone, which is kind of unusual. Usually I have a phone, but no case, which is not a good feeling. So I'm kind of glad the case arrived before the phone, and I'll have a case on day one now, so I'm looking forward to it. Really looking forward to playing with the camera, which is supposed to be outstanding. Not looking forward to a possible OLED display degradation within days of use, but we'll see how that goes. And I'm also looking forward to low light stuff. Okay, John, well, hopefully next week we'll have more fun things to talk about. This week was kind of light, in my opinion. I think we spent a lot of time on a product that doesn't exist, which is the Mac Mini.
Mm-hmm.
Or it doesn't exist. The new one doesn't exist. Okie dokie, as we head into Halloween season, hope everybody has a safe one as it comes up. What are we about next week? Yeah, next week, I guess.
Yep.
And we will talk to you next time.